From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a massive demonstration following the deadly terrorist attacks in Paris. A Muslim perspective of Islamic-rooted terrorism.
Muslims should be loyal to the places where they live, whichever country they are. These are the voices that need to be strengthened instead of giving the platform to these hate mongers.
The AirAsia 8501 data recorder is recovered from the Java Sea. And North and South Korea offer proposals to reduce tensions. I'm Susan Yawkey. More than 40 world leaders and 1.6 million people joined for a massive rally of solidarity Sunday in Paris, following France's deadliest terrorist attacks in decades. The group included German Chancellor Angela Merkel, British Prime Minister David Cameron, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. Similar rallies were held in other parts of France as well as cities around the world, bringing marchers to the streets of Berlin, Brussels, Istanbul, and Madrid. Lisa Bryant was on the scene in Paris.
The Place de la République in central Paris was a sea of people, so jam-packed that it took about a half an hour to move a few inches. Banners were brandished everywhere in support of love, free speech, democracy, and multiculturalism. Many simply read, "I am Charlie," in support of the dozen victims of Wednesday's attack on Charlie Hebdo magazine. Islamist militants have been blamed for the shooting and for two other attacks last week that killed a police officer and four Jewish men at a kosher market.
Ils n'ont pas vengé le prophète, ils l'ont insulté, ils l'ont déshonoré.
Mamoun Abdelali, an imam from the Paris area, was among many Muslims at the rally denouncing militant Islam. The assailants, he said, didn't avenge the Prophet Muhammad. They insulted and dishonored him. Another Muslim, 17-year-old Amina Tajouri, brandished a Jewish newspaper that read, "I am Jewish, I am Charlie."
We are not okay with that fact. We disagree. We totally disagree. Jews and Muslims refuse to be enemies, and we refuse to let people be killed for that. Everyone is allowed to talk. Everyone is allowed to say what he wants to say. And vive la France.
Dozens of heads of state, including Palestinian, Israeli, and African leaders, as well as UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, briefly joined French President François Hollande on the march. Earlier in the day, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder and European Interior Ministers held talks on terrorism in the capital. Security was unprecedented at the rally, with several thousand police and military deployed. The Paris terrorist attacks are the worst in recent French history. They have left many here, like teacher Edith Godin, in shock.
I'm like fed up with all the hatred in the world. I can't stand people hating each other anymore. And more than just liberty of freedom of expression, it's more like I want people to live together and I want people to just try to accept each other, even if they are different.
But not everyone here offered messages of reconciliation. Franklin Bouleau, sporting a red baseball cap, said he was afraid of Islam.
Ben moi je suis complètement peur de musulmans parce qu'en fait ils veulent complètement nous détruire notre société parce qu'on.
Bouleau said Muslims wanted to destroy French society and they were trying to kill the French people. French authorities are braced for other attacks. Hundreds of French have joined jihads in the Middle East. That may have been the case of at least one of the assailants. Police are still hunting a top suspect, the 26-year-old partner of one of the killers. Reports say she may have left the country before the shootings en route to Syria. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
What is the Muslim perspective of Islamic-rooted terrorism? For an answer, we spoke with Muslim American Fahim Yunus, national president of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Men Association of the U.S.
As a Muslim, Prophet Muhammad's honor is extremely dear to me, But I would protect his honor by giving life instead of taking life. Just like the Muslim French police officer who was the first victim of these terrorists, Susan, who died defending the right of this magazine to mock the Prophet. Even though it's extremely hurtful and distasteful to us, we as the Ahmadiyya Muslim community believe that there is not a single verse in Holy Quran that puts any gives any punishment for free speech, that blasphemy laws are un-Islamic, and we stand against that.
Is a violent response to the satirical journalism a clash of cultures, I say, of freedom of expression in the West versus respect for Islam among these extremists?
Not at all. Islam has a 1,400-year-long history, and there is a history of tolerance for centuries. This is a new virus within the body of Islam, Susan, where the clergy, the clerics, the leaders within the Muslim communities, they have created, concocted this virus of blasphemy laws that they're trying to link it to the core teachings of Islam. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, himself was blasphemed during his own life, but he pardoned each and every such person. Islam and Quran only teaches us to walk away from such situations. So this is not a clash of civilizations. This is actually a brain tumor. This is a misunderstanding of these Muslim clergy who are now then projecting this hatred to the young, disillusioned men in the Western societies.
The irony of this is that these terrorist attacks with Islamic roots, they're actually hurting the Muslim community in general.
They are the most hurtful, and you're absolutely right. More than 90% of the terror victims are unfortunately my Muslim brothers and sisters, my family members. So therefore, it is incumbent upon us, and that is what the Ahmadiyya Muslim community is calling upon all these Muslim communities for the past one century, that we need to unite under a reformist movement. We need to unite for pluralism, and we need to stand for various larger definitions of Islam. There is a reductionist thinking in Islam today where everything is being reduced. And we need to, the Muslims have to come up with a solution here to expand the definition that Quran gives of a Muslim, of what Islam is, what free speech rights are, and what the Prophet said, not what these clergies are trying to project on us.
You mentioned the Muslim community taking steps, but is there anything people outside the Muslim community can do to help get rid of these young, usually men, terrorists that are causing so much horror?
Absolutely, and I think what you are doing, I think we need to continue to strengthen the moderate voices. We need to continue to strengthen those who stand up for reform. To give you an example, USA Today just a few days ago ran this horrible op-ed by Anjum Chaudhary. This guy is to Islam what appendix is to a human body, Susan. This guy does not stand for anything. Nothing he says is supported by Holy Quran. And yet he is given the platform in one of the largest newspapers in the United States as compared to the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. We do have a voice and we do try to do our best. But here is a community that for over 100 years is standing up for jihad of the pen. The founder of this community has said over 100 years ago under British rule that he believes in separation of church and state and Muslims should be loyal to the places where they live, whichever country they are. These are the voices that need to be strengthened instead of giving the platform to these hate mongers.
Bayem Yunus, national president of the Ahmadiyya Muslim Men Association of the U.S. and a senior fellow of the Center for Ethics at the University of Baltimore. In the wake of the twin terrorist attacks in Paris, the White House announced it will host a summit on countering violent extremism, focusing on domestic and international efforts to curb extremist violence before it occurs. VOA's Victor Beatty reports U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, who met with European security officials in Paris Sunday, said there is an increasing need for countries to share information to counter such threats.
The White House says the February 18th summit will highlight domestic and international efforts to prevent violent extremists and their supporters from radicalizing, recruiting, or inspiring individuals or groups to commit acts of violence. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said these efforts have become more imperative in the light of recent attacks in Ottawa, Sydney, and now Paris. The summit presentations, panel discussions, and small group interactions will showcase programs in Boston, Los Angeles, and Minneapolis-St. Paul to integrate the efforts of educators, mental health professionals, religious leaders, law enforcement, the private sector, and technology community in heading off violent extremism. Summit presentations will also draw on the experience of other countries in trying to prevent attacks and foreign fighter recruitment. Holder said Sunday on the ABC program this week he made an appeal to European interior ministers to take part in the summit.
So that we can come up with a way in which we can deal with the root causes of what it is that attracts these young men to these really negative ideological groups.
The Attorney General says information sharing among nations is crucial in the fight against extremism.
One of the things that we have certainly gleaned from these interactions is there's a greater need for us to share information, to knock down these information sharing barriers so that we can always stay on top of these threats. One nation cannot by itself hope to forestall the possibility of terrorism, even within its own borders.
Jonathan Schanzer, a former terrorism finance analyst at the U.S. Treasury Department and now vice president of research at the Washington-based Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, says many of these efforts were started in the wake of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. He says the Paris events appear to have focused the Obama administration anew on the threat posed by terrorism.
The problem is that we may have lost a lot of valuable time. And I think probably another important thing to note here as well is just the way that the topic is framed is somewhat problematic. In other words, calling it violent extremism without talking about the ideology that spawns this violence, I think does us no favors. And ultimately, I think will put us in a position where we will not be in a position to win.
Schanzer says the U.S. already has important bilateral and multilateral intelligence-sharing relationships. He also says religious leaders, particularly Muslim, have been involved for years in efforts to diminish the terrorist threat.
Teachers, I think that could be a very interesting one. I think there's probably not been a lot of work with the various public school systems or even parochial schools. The question, though, is whether teachers are going to be able to be honest about what the challenge is without having to potentially insult students or their parents. Working with the tech community, this is obviously incredibly important. The tech community can provide a huge amount of clues, and we know that, for example, Twitter and Facebook and other social media outlets have been providing assistance to the intelligence community for many years now. But they have been fighting with one hand tied behind their back because, again, they are not allowed to profile. There is extreme sensitivity about what it is that we're looking for in the first place.
Schanzer says Europe has already been hit with high-profile terrorist attacks, noting the 2004 Madrid train attack and the 2007 London subway bombings. He's not sure the French attacks last week will fundamentally change Europe's approach to terrorism. Attorney General Holder says there is no credible information that al-Qaeda was behind last week's attacks in Paris. He says al-Qaeda's leadership has been decimated by more than a decade of reprisals.
The threat now really, I think, comes from al-Qaeda affiliates, and chief among them would be al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula.
Holder says they have the ability to inspire people, they have explosives experts, and a capacity unmatched by any other terrorist organization. As the French consider new security measures, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will arrive in France later this week for talks on countering extremist violence. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
The flight data recorder of AirAsia Flight 8501 has been retrieved from the Java Sea. Authorities say the cockpit voice recorder from the passenger jet that crashed on December 28th has also been located. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
Navy divers brought to the surface the flight data recorder of the Indonesia AirAsia flight 2 weeks after it crashed in the Java Sea. The head of Indonesia's search and rescue agency, Henry Bambam Soelistyo, says the data and voice recorders that compose the so-called black box had become separated.
Black box itu ada dua bagian. Satu adalah flight data recorder.
Soelistyo explains to reporters in Jakarta that divers of a joint search and rescue team found and lifted part of the black box containing the flight data recorder. The cockpit voice recorder, he adds, was not brought to the surface, but its location has been identified. It is hoped that the information contained on the two recorders will help investigators determine why the Airbus A320 plunged into the sea less than halfway into its two-hour flight from Surabaya to Singapore. All 162 people on board died. So far, fewer than 50 bodies have been retrieved. Search officials say they expect more bodies will be found in the submerged fuselage of the plane, which is in the sea's relatively shallow waters. Indonesia's transport ministry has suspended AirAsia's license for the Surabaya-Singapore route, for which it did not have permission to fly on that ill-fated Sunday. But the ministry says this had no bearing on the crash of Flight 8501, which is believed to have encountered a severe storm. Indonesia's president, Joko Widodo, says the crash has brought to light widespread problems with air travel management in the country, the world's fourth largest, which sprawls across an archipelago composed of thousands of islands. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
North and South Korean leaders are proposing different approaches to reduce the potential for military conflict in the region. VOA's correspondent in Seoul, Brian Padden, reports that given the level of mistrust between Pyongyang and the West, both proposals face significant opposition.
South Korean President Park Geun-hye said Monday she is ready to meet with her North Korean counterpart Kim Jong-un without any preconditions.
북한은 더 이상 주저하지 말고
North Korea should not hesitate anymore, she says, but come forward for dialogue. President Park says she would like to restart the process of engagement and rebuilding trust by initially focusing on issues where there is already broad agreement. She says she hopes for South Korea and North Korea to open the door for reunification by discussing the issue of divided families, improvement of quality of North Korean lives, and recovery of national identity. In his New Year's message, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un also indicated he is open to dialogue if the right atmosphere and environment is created. But Pyongyang has refused to engage with the South until and unless Seoul stops groups of activists from launching balloons full of anti-North Korean leaflets across the border. On that issue, President Park was somewhat vague. She said that although the basic right of freedom of expression must be protected, the government can request that these groups refrain from their activities for public safety reasons. However, she also defended the need for the South's controversial national security law, which has been used to arrest people seen as making sympathetic comments about the North and restrict discussion about the South's policies on Pyongyang. North Korea has made its own proposal for reducing regional tension by offering a moratorium on nuclear tests in exchange for an end to joint U.S.-South Korean military drills. The U.S. and South Korea rejected this proposal, saying it was an implied threat. North Korea is already under U.N. sanctions for conducting banned nuclear tests in the past. Korea analyst John DeLory with Yonsei University in Seoul is surprised that North Korea's offer was so quickly rejected.
You know, this is the kind of starting point you have to look for. You're not going to get Pyongyang to say, okay, we give up. Here's all the plutonium and uranium. Let's call it a day. You have to work, in a painful step-by-step way.
DeLory says these proposals can lead to constructive dialogue, but only if there is the political will on all sides to work towards a peaceful solution. Washington's position has been to demand that Pyongyang first take action to curb its nuclear program before any talks can resume. The U.S. recently imposed new sanctions on Pyongyang over the alleged North Korean hacking of a movie studio that released a comedy about the assassination of leader Kim Jong-un. North Korea has denied responsibility for the cyber attacks. Brian Padden, VOA News, Seoul.
A movie that took 12 years to make won the top dramatic film prize at the Hollywood Foreign Press Association's 72nd Annual Golden Globes Award Sunday in Beverly Hills, California. Boyhood won awards for Best Dramatic Film, the Best Director Prize for Richard Linklater, and Best Supporting Actress Award for Patricia Arquette. The Grand Budapest Hotel won the Golden Globe for Best Musical or Comedy Film, beating out Birdman, Into the Woods, Pride, and St. Vincent. Gina Rodriguez took home the Globe for Best Comedy TV Actress for her performance in Jane the Virgin, based on a Venezuelan telenovela. The Best Television Drama Globe went to The Affair and Ruth Wilson. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On January 12, 1554, Bayan Nang was crowned King of Burma. He would go on to create the largest empire in the history of Southeast Asia. In 1879, British troops and Zulu tribesmen fought in the first encounter of the Anglo-Zulu War. Within 6 months, the British had subdued the Zulu nation and scattered all opposition. In 1911, the University of the Philippines College of Law was formally established. In 1913, Joseph Jugashvili, for the first time, signed his name as Stalin, meaning Man of Steel, in a letter to a newspaper. Stalin would later become dictator of the Soviet Union and be responsible for the deaths of millions of people. In 1959, Berry Gordy Jr. formed Motown Records, originally Tamla Records, in Detroit. In 1970, the breakaway region of Biafra capitulated to Nigerian government forces after two major defeats, ending the Nigerian Civil War. The next day, Biafran forces surrendered. On this day in 1976, iconic English mystery writer Agatha Christie died at the age of 85. In 1991, the U.S. Congress gave President George H.W. Bush authority to use military force to expel invading Iraqi forces from Kuwait. On this day in 2006, Mehmet Ali Agca, the Turkish gunman who shot Pope John Paul II in 1981, was released from prison after serving more than 25 years in jail. And on this day in 2006, a stampede broke out during the Islamic Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia, killing more than 360 people. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of Labor has awarded $10 million toward a cooperative agreement with an NGO to implement a project addressing exploitative labor among youth in Ethiopia. The effort, to be conducted with the group World Vision, aims to help vulnerable youth in Ethiopia develop the skills they need to make a successful transition into good jobs. We know when youth are provided skills training and career services that align with needs in the jobs market, they are less likely to be drawn into exploitative labor, Deputy Undersecretary of Labor for International Affairs Carol Pierce said in announcing the award. The project will promote education and vocational training opportunities and seek to enhance livelihoods and access to social protection programs for youth and their households, focusing specifically on the needs of girls. The project aims to address exploitative child labor by providing youth ages 14 to 17 with marketable skills and support to secure decent work. The project will also support President Obama's Young African Leaders Initiative. Since 1993, the ILAB has produced reports to raise awareness globally about child labor and forced labor. ILAB has also provided funding for more than 280 projects in more than 94 countries to combat the worst forms of child labor by providing assistance to vulnerable children and their families. Based in Washington State, World Vision is a nonprofit humanitarian organization conducting relief, development, and advocacy activities in its work with children, families, and their communities in nearly 100 countries to help them reach their full potential by tackling the causes of poverty and injustice. In its 2013 report on human rights practices, the U.S. Department of State noted that the lack of labor inspectors and controls prevented the Ethiopian government from enforcing the law. The resources for inspections and the implementation of penalties were extremely limited. This project builds on the successes of the Ethiopians Fighting Against Child Exploitation project that was also implemented by World Vision in 2011 to 2014.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.